You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is the Bike Show. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative, open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday, year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Como El Ere, an evening of flamenco featuring direct from Spain guitarist Carlos de Jacoba on Saturday, March 7th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. at Resound Northwest in Portland. Como El Ere featuring Diego Amador Jr. and hosted by Savannah Fuentes brings you the intense energy and emotion of flamenco. Again, that's Como El Ere, an evening of flamenco featuring direct from Spain guitarist Carlos de Jacoba on Saturday, March 7th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. at Resound Northwest, 1532 Southwest Jefferson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come join in the conversation with ML Laurie on our new podcast, What the Hell is Going On? A conversation about our human experience, our human condition, and the obstacles that we all have to happiness. This podcast is an extension of the segment, Let's Stop for a Minute, that ML produced for the KBOO radio show, The Politics of Living. So go to kboo.fm/whatthehellisgoingon, or you can go to www.kboo.fm, audio, podcasts, and What the Hell is Going On.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Honeyland chronicles a Macedonian woman's journey in strife while cultivating honey using ancient beekeeping traditions. Again, that's Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Tori Bortman, and glad to be here with you this morning. Portland is home base for the Bike Show, but our fair city has been often, and not unreasonably, criticized for not having the mountain bike infrastructure of other world-class cycling cities. On today's show, we'll be talking with Nancy Stone and Jutu Oberg of the Northwest Trail Alliance, the area's premier nonprofit support for mountain biking, about what new opportunities might be coming to the Portland, Oregon area. We're also excited to have Paul Dickow, chair of the Friends of Gateway Green, Portland Metro's largest public mountain bike park, to share with us why we won't have access to the park until November of this year. But first, we're here with the KBOO News Minute. The Guardian newspaper reports that in Finland, progressive policies help get people on their bike, even in below-freezing conditions. Journalist Peter Walker visited the city of Joensuu in eastern Finland, where the temperature was negative 16 Celsius, or 3 degrees Fahrenheit, and a layer of compacted snow covered everything. Yet, one of the first things he noticed was that about 20% of all trips were cycled. Walker attended the Winter Cycling Congress, an annual gathering of researchers, academics, and city officials. He concludes that while winter cycling presents many challenges, if you want more people on bikes in winter, it's less about individuals than infrastructure. The compacted snow means that almost everyone riding has been using everyday bikes with ordinary tires. Ari Veronen, the chief The city's chief roads engineers explains that bike routes are plowed with the same tractors used for roads. They have a blade to push away fresh snow and add grooves to the surface to make it less slippery. The lanes are then gridded rather than using bike corroding salt. If the weather stays below freezing, all is fine, but when the temperature goes above 0 Celsius, it becomes very slushy, and then it freezes again. It's pure ice and really bouncy. At this point, the residents agree it's only best to venture out on a bike with tires fitted with metal studs, given you can never be sure if a newly refrozen track has been freshly gridded. The city built a comprehensive system of separated bike routes, some just for bikes, which increases the sense of safety. Walker writes that if you want a lot of people to cycle, you need consistent political will to spend money on proper cycling facilities over the long term. Politicians in Joensuu are committed to cycling, including the mayor, Kari Karjalian, who at the gathering took his turn pedaling the bike used to power the event's PA system. The city is committed to becoming carbon neutral by 2025, and that involves reducing significantly reducing transport emissions. The Finnish government appears equally committed with a funding program in place for active travel as part of a target to increase walking and cycling by 30% by 2030. The country as a whole has pledged to become carbon neutral by 2030, 20 years before the UK's deadline. The opening of the event of the Winter Cycling Congress took place at the city's main school, where teachers say about half the pupils still ride to school in winter. On the morning in question, it was negative 13, but the school's bike racks were full. Walker concludes that this is something to think about next time you wonder whether you can face a bike ride in winter. The Washington Post reports that Washington, D.C. could pay people to ride transit, walk, or bike to work. D.C. has the highest percentage of commuters in the country walking and biking to work, an estimated 18%, according to the 2016 American Community Survey, with another 37% taking transit. However, employer benefits are set up to give the biggest reward to people who drive by subsidizing parking. This means more traffic and longer commutes. A bill in the D.C. Council would give employees the chance to trade in their parking space for extra cash and encourage drivers to explore other commuting options. Right now, employers can choose to give workers a commuting benefit of up to $270 a month for parking and $270 a month for public transit. People who walk or bike to work are completely on their own. D.C. Council members Charles Allen and Mary Che have proposed a plan to give people an equally strong incentive to ride transit, bike, or walk to work, the Transit Transportation Benefits Equity Act. Employers with 20 or more workers that offer employees subsidized parking would have to alternatively let employees trade in that benefit for cash. That means employees who walk or bike would now have the chance to pocket the value of their parking space as taxable income or use the parking benefit for transit while pocketing the balance. Cheryl Court, policy director of the Coalition for Smarter Growth, estimates that the bill could even end up benefiting employers in the long run. According to the World Resources Institute, converting non-active employee into a bike commuter saves $3,000 in employer health care costs and reduced absenteeism. The bill will be voted on later this month. And for our listeners here in Portland, Oregon, on March 10th at 5:45 p.m., Bike Loud is co-hosting a transportation forum with the 14 candidates running for mayoral and commissioner races. The event will take place at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, check forum.bikeloudpdx.org. That was our News Minute update. Our first guest today is Paul Dickow, chair of Friends of Gateway Green. While Paul Dickow is an expert in landscape design, he's not actually a mountain biker, but we're still thrilled as ever to have him here with us, as he's best positioned to explain why our beloved park will be closing for the next 8 months, what progress has been made on the park thus far, and what huge changes are ahead for the park's reopening. Paul Dickow, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you aren't a mountain biker traditionally. How did you get involved with Gateway Green? And for those listeners who don't know, Gateway Green is Portland's largest urban mountain bike park that we have.
Okay, so I got involved in it when I bought a house in the area in 2014, and I had a colleague. So I'm the marketing director at a landscape architecture office, and a colleague who has a similar role at another office, who's an avid cyclist, Beth Lanigan from Alta, was part of the board at that time, and I reached out and I said, hey, you know, I now live right by the park site and I've been tracking it, and is there anything I can do to help volunteer? Because I wanted to do something in my community. So that was sort of my entry point. I helped write grants, primarily grant applications, because at that time the board was, the city had acquired the site from ODOT. The Oregon Department of Transportation owned that property. They still own some spaces around it. The city acquired the Gateway Green site around that time, and we were assisting significantly with the fundraising aspects of being able to turn it into an actively used, fully outfitted park space.
Because it's surrounded, can you describe kind of the environs of the park a little bit for their listeners who haven't seen it before? I actually was talking to somebody in the neighborhood today and they were like, where is it?
So right.
It's a little tricky to get to if you're not aware.
Yeah, it's a really interesting place. And that was part of what attracted me to it, is I'm really interested in how land is used. And so if you've ever taken the MAX Red Line to the airport, right after you leave Gateway Transit Center, you pass a pretty big sort of unidentified green space, and that is Gateway Green. It's off to your right if you're headed north. You can also see parts of it from the freeway, but not as well. So it's a 24-acre slice of land that's tucked in between I-84 and I-205 at the place where those freeways are parallel. And it's right on the, it sort of forms the border between Northeast Portland and East Portland. And it's a really large piece of land, but it's sort of long and skinny. And it was a leftover space from this gully that existed between Rocky Butte and the sort of terrace, the plateau that forms East Portland. And there were all, you know, all kinds of uses there historically. And then it got filled in with the freeways. And this little slice of land, this big slice of land was left over.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. If you've ever glanced at it, it seems quite small, but it's really, it's one of our larger pieces, parcels of land as far as parks go. I mean, nothing compares to Forest Park, but it's a big piece of land, which made it very ready to be, not ready, maybe that's not the right word, but it's a great opportunity for the mountain bike use because there's enough land to get trails on it.
Yeah, and because it had been impacted by all this human development and construction, it didn't represent some of the same environmental, or it didn't create some of the same environmental fears that mountain biking had cropped up around mountain biking in other areas. And so there's really, you can only improve this property. You know, it's basically a landfill with construction debris. It has really interesting,
a really pretty looking landfill.
Yes,
just so you know, the stuff that's been filled in has been topped with soil, so it actually looks like a beautiful green space.
And a forest grew up on top of it.
Yeah.
So you have this tremendous kind of volunteer forest that's at the very heart of it. And yeah, you come up, you start, you know, if you're coming from the south, you start at a very large knoll that allows you to see deep into this gully and into the forest, and it's a remarkable place. But from a habitat standpoint, it really needs a lot of help. So as we were introducing types of recreation there, it was apparent that any input would really be helping the forest quality rather than hurting it.
It was so neglected.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, it was very neglected.
So you got involved, you started grant writing, you're still there. I can hear in your voice when you talk about it, the park with so much pride. That's probably part of the reason you stayed, but what kind of hooked you in?
Well, I was intrigued by the novel use of the place. Well, first of all, it's just commitment to the group and to the community. The people that started Friends of Gateway Green have been so committed to the Gateway area at large. Their commitment to Gateway Green is actually part of a bigger pattern of community-driven investment in the entire area. Gateway Green itself, interestingly, falls right outside of Gateway District officially. It's actually in the Madison South neighborhood. But physically, it makes sense to be included in kind of the vision for Gateway as a community development area.
Because the only two places you can access it from, because of the highways, are Gateway and Maywood Park.
Right, exactly.
So it even though it's attached to Madison, there's this, I don't know, I-205 in the way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so that community, their commitment, that was just motivating to me to, you know, there weren't a lot of, there needs to be more people my age getting involved. You know, we have some people that are trying to retire from full-time activism. And so I saw a role there in terms of giving back to my community with some expertise that I had, and trying to make something interesting happen. For me personally, I thought it was pretty intriguing that this use could be introduced in a place, and that it was an opportunity to prove the compatibility of mountain biking alongside other traditional park uses, alongside habitat restoration, and to have kind of a pilot project for demonstrating that. It's an idea not found at other parks in the city, and I had almost, academic is the wrong way to put it, but I had kind of an interest in that for its own sake, that trying that experiment, we would learn something about it, we would learn something about using urban space, and we would learn something about what happens with these different types of investments in my area where I lived, or where I live now. So there's also kind of a professional component, which is that I'm the marketing director of a landscape architecture office. My job is to go out and help my company bid on new projects to design. And I had never been a client, so I'm often making the pitch. And in this particular instance, I was actually more sort of partnering with the city and seeing how a place like this gets made, so that in my professional life, I have a little bit more perspective about what it means to have that role in a project.
That's amazing. That's so great. So can you talk a little bit about what Gateway Green phase one is, what exists right now? Can you talk about what phase one was, why it's being done in phases, which is, I think, both an economic and logistical thing, and why the park's going to be closing?
Right.
Temporarily.
That's the big question everybody's asking, so we could start there. So the park is going to be closing possibly Monday. For those of you who ride and are listening, get your rides in this week and weekend, and I'm hopeful that the good weather holds out for everybody who wants to enjoy the space. The reason why it's closing is we're doing a massive construction project. It is really large. Phase one, we called the Dirt Lab. That was a community-funded project. It's possible some listeners contributed to the crowdfunding that helped drive that forward. And the Dirt Lab was conceived of as a space where a lot of the essential elements like single track and skills area and pump track could be tried out for the first time on a city-owned property. And that was done in collaboration with Northwest Trail Alliance. It was done, parts of it were done by professional trail contractors that were brought into the project. And it's really a test bed for these uses. And there was a lot of trial and error involved. So as a lab, it's kind of conceived of as it's not a static area. These are elements that we've modified to best fit the user's needs.
How many miles of single track are there? And can you talk about the skills area, what that looks like?
I am blanking on the amount of single track.
I want to say it's like 6 to 8, 3? Is it only 3? I can get a good 6 to 8 miles out of Gateway Green. It's 3 miles officially of single track, but it's so well done, and it's interesting. You can do laps on it. The skills area, there's a pump track, but there's also it's got features where you can do jumps and or roll through different features for kids and adults to get better at getting good lines and all the things that as mountain bikers we need to work on. So
yeah, it's been really, I'm an avid road biker. I've gotten out there on a mountain bike a few times and kind of flailed around. It's really fun, but it's amazing just to go be a spectator there and see this happen. With the Dirt Lab, I think we wanted to understand, if you add these uses there, what are the best places to observe from? How does it work for users of all ages? How does it work for families? And we wanted to have this information to inform the design of the park other park features and the park infrastructure that would actually serve this use. So it's, where do people organically want to hang out? Where is it easiest to, for a child to hear their parent if they're shouting at them? Where are the best views? This is information that we wanted to learn from the Dirt Lab phase. So it was almost a beta version of the park.
And it was a little bit of like low hanging fruit too. It's not super easy or simple to try to make well thought out trails, but that compared to building a building in a spot that's going to be permanent, if a trail doesn't work well, we can redesign it and put things in and make a new trail or change the trail. Whereas once you put a building in or a viewing area in, that's where it's going to go. So phase one was kind of the soft. So phase two, which is what this closure is about, what's coming?
So,
and what did you learn? It sounds like you did a lot of observation. So what did you find out?
Well, we learned a lot about the grades. So the slopes getting in and out of the park are substantial. And in its current condition, it's not fully accessible, universally accessible by ADA standards. And all city parks need to be at a bare minimum. A lot of them exceed the minimum. And we wanted to understand what was difficult for people getting in and out, whether the skills areas were appropriate to all users. And we did learn a lot about how, you know, beginner, intermediate, and advanced users are or aren't being served. That was really important for the bike pieces. We learned a lot about sort of adjunct uses. So if you have a family that comes down and they want to spend an afternoon, not all of the members of the family will do all the same activities. So we were looking at how long are people staying? What else might they want to do that's compatible? How close do those uses need to be to the core use areas, like the skills elements? So it informed a lot about how we'll locate some of the kind of visitor arrival and hangout space. There's the big idea behind the overall park design. Greenworks Landscape Architecture was the landscape architect who led that process with the city. The big idea was that sort of at its edges where you come in, there's a formality to it and you've arrived at a park and it really looks and feels like a fully built out Portland park. As you get more towards the interior, you get more of that sense of the forest and wild escape that I think a lot of people are looking for in an urban area, and more of a natural experience. So there's a big central hangout area that's going to get built. There will be a Portland Loo.
Ooh, that's exciting.
So that's a big deal. So we have no utilities or no street frontage at this site. It's a very difficult place to construct things. So we're adding utilities, we're adding water.
And I'm gonna have you hold that thought for just a moment. You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting here from the KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. We're here with Paul Dickow, chair of the Friends of Gateway Green, and he's telling us all about the big changes that are coming to the park. So a toilet is always an exciting.
Yeah.
Especially at a place where I feel like, well, any park, the hope is that you're going to come and stay a minute. And especially with kids, people with disabilities, not that they have to go to the bathroom any more than anybody, but when you got to go, you got to go, and you want there to be a facility that's pretty readily available.
Yeah, and drinking water. So notably, if you're a user of the I-205 multi-use path, either for commuting or walking or biking, whatever it is, there are very few places to stop and rest. So there will be water, there will be the loo, there will be shade. That's a really important piece out there. So we're planting a lot of trees.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. There's a lot of restoration pieces. So a lot of the landscape is going to be restored with native or climate adaptive plants that are going to be better to serve the habitat there. Most of the work is happening outside of the forest. The forest restoration work is being done by FOG and other partners like Friends of Trees in the city. The big hangout area will also include a big event space with utilities to support vendors and other, sound system or other needs for events. As we have had huge events out there with Northwest Trail Alliance, we do Take a Kid Mountain Biking Day, and I think 1,000 people came. So we had all kinds of vendors. Yeah, there'll be a lot more support for
them. You probably
need
a PA system when you're up that.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course food, it was a really big effort. So this is a type of space that could be used by camps. It could be used by picnics, you know, so.
Will there be an actual playground there at some point?
There will be what we call a natural play or a nature-based playground. Oh, so it'll lovely. Be sort of, it won't be sort of like a swing set and the things you see at more of a city urban park. It'll be a little bit more kind of fun, like logs and boulder climbs and that kind of stuff.
Excellent. So it's so if the kids are riding around and you're there for the afternoon, they can take a break from the bike, or if somebody's less interested in the bike and more interested in climbing, they can go do something else for a minute.
Yes, and I would encourage anybody that just enjoys being outside and strolling to parks to go check it out. Just, you know, I go there about every other weekend just to kind of watch and see what's going on. There are great views to Rocky Butte, great wildlife, and increasingly it's really just interesting to see people, you know, jumps on their bike. So we want to engage users who of all interests in the space.
That's great. So phase two, we've got the loo, we've got an event area. Why does it take 8 months? Because it's supposed to be through November, correct?
Right. So the level of work that's being done, the dirt lab, people may remember, it happened really fast. It was, you know, kind of these elements that could be just put into the current condition. We're really completely transforming the landscape. That means bulldozers and dump trucks and...
Well, and you mentioned earlier that this land had many uses, and one of those was a construction kind of landfill. So what might they find under that earth?
Hopefully nothing.
But potentially.
Yes, it's possible. It's probably slabs of concrete. Because I think an overpass was kind of
so maybe
dumped
some rebar
in there somewhere.
And concrete.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yeah, I did personally pull a tire out of the forest once. It had worked its way up. There's been so much restoration out there. It's really wild the amount of stuff, you know, to change to make the site improved. And the landscape form, the slopes and how it's put together is going to change substantially. The basic idea, the sort of the hill and the central basin, the basic elements are there, but we're going to regrade it for full accessibility.
Excellent. And will that be on the on the single track trails, or will that be mostly in the road area, the access road?
The single track trails are in the forest, and the forest is completely outside the limit of work. It's an environmentally protected zone, which means that the only things we can do there are making the forest better or 30-inch wide single track trails. That's the limit of what we're allowed to develop there. And that's great because it preserves this wild area for that sense of escape that people are really looking for. Now, the hillsides change quite a bit. We'll have a central spine of access, a big sort of multi-purpose road that comes down the center.
And that'll be gravel?
It'll be a really finely crushed gravel. So that will be able to serve all, you know, bikers and walkers. It will also serve emergency vehicle access in the event that they have to come onto the site, and maintenance vehicles, which currently all of those users have actually pretty hard time getting out onto the site. So the main reason that it's going to take till November is it just takes a lot of time to move the dirt, get it right, get things, you know, put in place, verify
plumbing.
That it's plumbing is a huge deal. Electrical is a huge deal. And these things take a lot of time. We also need some dry weather. A lot more wet weather construction can happen these days, particularly for buildings. But for this landscape, we really need some window of dry weather to get this done.
Excellent. So November is the goal. And that's phase two. Phase three?
Phase three...
Theoretically?
It's looking very real. So to give some context for phase three, TriMet is a partner for the project with the city, and phase three is going to come after they install a project called the Better Red Project. And that could be a whole radio show on its own, but basically the Better Red Project improves the red line at a bunch of key locations, and one of them is right on Gateway Green. And since their project interacts with ours, we're going to wait to construct the part of the park impacted by their work until after, or we're going to do it while they're doing their project or as it's ending. So that is the southern portion. So it's that big hill that you see, that you can see from the Halsey Street overpass.
Mm-hmm.
It's
kind of a grassland right now.
Exactly. It's a big kind of round knoll, and that will get done as part of that later TriMet project. So it's a few years out, but it's pretty near.
So we'll have the park back for a few years before it goes off limits, I guess.
Right, and actually, it won't go completely off limits.
Oh, great.
It'll just be that chunk. So, you know, while TriMet's doing their work, presumably, as far as we know today, the core area of the park is still usable. So,
excellent. So we won't have a complete shutdown. Speaking of shutdowns, where should people go in the meantime? If they want to, is there any other options besides Gateway Green in Portland?
Yeah, the nearest option is Ventura Park. It has a pump track at 113th and Stark, which is less than 2 miles from Gateway Green.
Excellent. And I know Powell Butte has some a little bit. There's a few other places around town, but unfortunately, our Gateway Green is going under construction for a moment. But it sounds like it's going to be such a better place. I'm just really excited for a bathroom myself.
It's going to be transformative. It's going to feel like a real park at the same time as that sense of kind of, one of the beautiful things about it today is you feel like you jumped the fence. I grew up in a rural area, and that sense of like when you go ride your BMX bike at the gravel pile or behind the factory, you know, a lot of places you're sort of not supposed to be. Gateway Green has that charm of an urban landscape where people can, you know, exercise their imagination a little bit, and that will be preserved in the new design at the same time as there'll just be more amenities for people.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely has that. My favorite part, I usually come into Gateway Green from the north, and my favorite part is as you're coming in, there's an access bridge, and you're looking down at people often because I'm there in the afternoon or evening stuck in traffic on I-84, and I'm just cruising along on my mountain bike, heading into this magical hidden green space that I'm like, sorry you're in your car. I'm going to go have fun over here. So I'm really glad Gateway Green is there. And I feel like, yes, that is definitely a part of the charm of Gateway Green, is kind of a secret garden of sorts back there. Well, thank you so much. I can't believe we're already halfway through the show today. We've been here with Paul Dickow, Chair of Friends of Gateway Green. Thank you so much for being here with us. If our listeners want to find out more about the park or the closure, where can they find that info?
So the City of Portland have a great website where they're talking about all the emerging changes. They have an image you can see that shows the new park layout, and they'll have ongoing information. I didn't memorize the URL, but if you go to City of Portland Parks and Recreation and search Gateway Green, that should come up. They'll have ongoing information about the dates.
Excellent. Paul Dickow, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM on the web. Stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our conversation about mountain bike opportunities and obstacles in Portland, when we'll be joined by Juntu Oberg and Nancy Stone of the Northwest Trail Alliance. I'm like, yeah. Broadcasting from KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. We're continuing our conversation about mountain bike opportunities and obstacles in Portland. Right now, we're joined by two board members of the Northwest Trail Alliance, one of the largest regional advocacy groups in the nation. Their mission includes stewarding trails and advocating for trail access across Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington, covering the Portland metro area as far to the north as Mount St. Helens, to the western slopes of Mount Hood, and as far west as Seaside. Juntu Oberg is the vice president of the board, and Nancy Stone is the newly minted director of education and sustainability. Juntu Oberg and Nancy Stone, welcome to the bike show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tori.
It's so great to have you here. Gateway Green is definitely one opportunity, and that's going on hold for a minute, but I know there's a lot of other things coming up with the Northwest Trail Alliance. So can Juntu Oberg, can you talk a little bit about what the Northwest Trail Alliance is really focused on right now as an organization for people who aren't as familiar?
Yeah, so we are the local land stewards of in partnership with soft surface trails that are open to cycling. Our partners include the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Oregon Department of Forestry, Portland Parks, and also some private landowners too. Our membership has grown tremendously, and it's definitely brought out a lot of mountain bikers in the area supporting our mission. When I first started with the board, we had about 900 members mid-2018. At the moment, we're at 2,500 paying dues members. Yeah, super exciting. And 500 of that is families. So we've definitely gotten a call of focusing our energies to open up areas where families can access nature on two wheels. So
that's fantastic. So Nancy Stone, you are new to the Director of Education and Sustainability position, because it is a new position with the Northwest Trail Alliance. Why was that position created?
Well, we wanted to formalize what our organization had already been doing for years. And by doing this, we were able to offer the general public, we were able to offer it to the general public and engage future land stewards.
So what does that mean? I mean, education and sustainability sounds good on paper, but what does that actually mean? What falls under that?
Well, we've basically created a program, a training program. It's a two-pronged training program for trail users who are new to trail work. And we also have a training program for experienced trail stewards to move into more of a leadership position.
And what are the names of those programs?
The Trail School
is for
new people who are new to trail work, and we're basically showing them the ropes, giving them the tools to be able to build and maintain trails, to know what they're doing when they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
And really it's focused on safety first and foremost. We put a lot of effort into making sure that everybody is practicing safe trail building, because we are out there using some pretty heavy duty trail building tools. And so we focus a lot on safety. We also are focusing on using sustainable practices that that ensure that we are not having a huge impact on the forest, we're not having a huge impact on the surrounding waterways, and that we're building trail that's going to last, that we don't have to go back every few months to do maintenance on, that it's going to last, that we don't have to spend a lot of time and effort going back.
Well, and everything needs a little, in the winter, if it's a more rural or U.S. forest land, things need to be cut out. There's blowdown in the winter of trees coming down or things like that, and that's our normal yearly maintenance.
Right.
But we want the trails potentially to last as long as possible without needing a bunch of dirt moved in the first place.
Right.
So Juntu Oberg, it sounds like this was a super important part of the Northwest Trail Alliance's kind of where they're headed. You're headed right now. Is this just for mountain bikers, or can anyone? Will these trail building? Will this knowledge be applicable to somebody who's a hiker?
Yeah, most of the curriculum that we have is for multi-user trails. There's obviously a trail out in the Tillamook State Forest is not going to be the same trail at Sandy Ridge. So we
Why?
Have, because of the purpose built and the number of users that are kind of within that area. So the Tillamook State Forest.
Can you talk a little? Yeah.
Yes. Ahead. So the Tillamook State Forest has multi-user trails that are open to hikers, bikers, equestrians. A place like Sandy Ridge or is a bit more in line of a bike park type facility where it was a different kind of trail construction and different kind of grade and different kind of skill set. Similar to the jumps and progressive lines at Gateway Green, it's just a different building technique. So we offer different levels of expertise.
And what would those, for people who don't mountain bike, yeah. What would that kind of what is a purpose-built trail maybe look like as compared to something in the Tillamook Forest or Pioneer Bridle Trail or something like that that's also a hiker trail?
So a purpose-built trail is just mountain bike optimized.
But what does that look like?
It takes into the grade and the switchbacks and kind of maximum amount of fun that you can have purposefully on your bike.
Nancy Stone?
Yeah. So the other key difference before, as a mountain biker, I was a hiker and I was a backpacker. A big difference in the trail is that mountain bikers are kind of in it for the long run. We're not necessarily going from point A to point B. We're kind of meandering through that, and we're looking to get the extra mileage in between. And as a hiker, I don't want to see the trail that I just climbed up on as I have kind of gone into the forest and coming back around and you see the same one. I want to know that I'm making more progress than that.
Right.
But as a mountain biker, I don't want to be climbing really steep trail. I want to be able to take my time and enjoy the whole experience.
Okay, so what about the surface? How does the surface change for a purpose-built versus a more traditional hiking trail?
It's really based on the topography of the different areas that we steward.
Would you say that the surface is more manipulated?
I think more of organics, kind of the top layer that erodes. Those trails are what you would call manipulated or taken care of. You know, the last thing that we want to do is create erosion or more work or having to come in and have to armor something and bring in a foreign item to make a trail more sustainable.
So you're trying to make it sustainable with what's there as much as possible. And you're also very aware of erosion, not just for the trail itself, because we want the trail to be there, but erosion concerns definitely affect other things down the line.
Correct.
Right. So when we are looking at building a trail or even maintaining a trail, we want it to work with the forest as best as we can, so where it has little to no impact. So that means, you know, in the Northwest, we get a fair amount of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to take that into consideration when we're building a trail. Where is this water going to go? And where is our trail going to go? So we need to look at how the topography of the land rises and falls, and we want to stay away from those low points that collect water, and we really want the water to shed right off of the trail.
And not create a puddle. Okay.
And also to not create erosion, and that you know affects the waterways. And the habitat, especially of salmon. And so we try to be really mindful of that. The one thing that's true about mountain bikers is that, you know, we love to be outside, and we love what we have here. We love the environment. We love the green spaces that we get to play in, and we want to preserve that. And so we put that into consideration when we're out there building.
Yeah, and that's something I'm sure you're also teaching as part of your trail school then.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. That's a huge part of what we're providing them. And people dig that.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally and figuratively yeah. dig it. And they want to be a part of it.
Yeah, and I know Paul and Dickow in our last segment spoke about how there was like a forested area in Gateway Green, and that was limited to a 30-inch width trail space. I think there's sometimes, depending on people see mountain bikers in a forest and they're like, oh, they're going to make these mega wide, crazy dig through trails, and don't realize, no, we're taking into account
right.
a lot of times to make the smallest impact. That's why we call it single track, because it's hopefully just going to be a single line of a wheel of a tire, or maybe a little bit more than that, but not much, maybe 18 inches or a foot or whatnot, so that we're making the smallest impact possible.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, it depends on where you're at and what trail, why you're building the trail that you're building. You know, if you're building something for kids, you want it to be a little bit wider. You want to have them to have a little bit more space to move around and to have a good sight line so they can see what's coming. But for a lot of the true single track, you know, mountain bikers want to have that feeling like they are out in the woods. And when you have a paved path, you know, basically, or a really wide path, you're not getting the same feeling.
Straight.
Right.
You said sight lines, and one thing that really affects mountain bikers versus hikers, I think, is we actually don't necessarily, we like to see where we're going, of course, but many prefer meandering a little bit because mm-hmm. it's more interesting than just this straight line that you can bomb through. Mm-hmm. There's some fun to it, but it gets really boring really fast if it doesn't meander a little bit. And meandering is better for trail development as well, like that sustainability.
Absolutely, because then you can kind of pick and choose where you're going to go. You're not cutting down any trees to get there. You're going around them. And you can, when you see a cool feature out in the woods, even if it's, you know, maybe a 100-year-old stump, but it's huge, it's from old growth, and you can kind of bring your trail right around it. So when people are riding it, they go, wow, that is so cool.
Yeah. So Juntu Oberg, what is the crew leader training? That's the second tier, right? You've maybe been trained, you've been coming along. And who are you? Who is that part of the program aimed at?
Yeah, so it's folks that have, like as you said, folks that have been a bit more experienced and have come to a couple...
Experience in trail maintenance.
Maintenance, and have come to a couple Northwest Trail Alliance work parties and are interested in kind of giving back more of what they can do. And it's bringing them kind of into the fold as far as like the next level of how to run a work party. Our organization as a whole last year had 20,000 volunteer hours. 18,000 of that was actual work party work.
And for our listeners who don't know what a work party looks like, can you describe what a work party kind of is?
So they range in sizes from a small group of folks who are out on the weekend
what
fixing.
Would small be?
Anywhere from 3 to 5 to 10. Okay. Something manageable is kind of a small work crew, and there's one leader, and they go out and clear drains and cut back some, you know, foliage that's encroaching into the trail. And some of our larger work parties are literally parties. They can be up to 100 folks coming out for a day, or we will do a camp out up in Mount St. Helens. It's one of our signature events called St. Helens Festival of Trails. We do 3 days, 2 days of riding your bike and 1 day of trail work. And we need people to lead crews to keep our work going, and with the growth of our membership too, we needed to expand our portfolio of expertise. So we had Nancy come up with the curriculum for the Trail Crew Leader Program.
And Nancy, did you just come up with that curriculum, or did you base it off of something else that's existing? Are there other groups even doing this kind of work?
Well, As far as I know, in the Northwest, there's other groups, like for instance, Trail Keepers of Oregon or Washington Trails Association, that have programs, I think, that are similar to this. Mm-hmm. But their focus is primarily on hiking trails. And, you know, we do a lot with multi-user trails, but we do a lot more with mountain bike specific trails. So Sandy Ridge, Rocky Point, even Stubbs Stewart or out of the coast at Cloche Creek, those are all mountain bike specific trails. And like we were saying earlier, we just handle them a little bit differently than you would a multi-user trail or hiking trail. So we needed a program that reflected that and that that kind of met those needs in a different way.
Yeah. And so you get a party, a work party, and you get 100 people. You get 10 people, and it's okay. You maybe need 2 crew leaders, maybe just one. But you get 100 people, and it starts, I know there was a different trail organization. I was out riding at Post Canyon, and they had like 200 people show up one day. Mm-hmm. And it gets to be herding cats. People are walking all over each other. They're getting in each other's way. You are using those heavy tools.
Right.
So is part of the leadership is also making sure you have the appropriate amount of cat herders.
But that's funny that you say that, because that's actually a term that we use quite often, is your job is to herd cats. We have a lot of cats running around in the forest, and you just need to make sure that they know where they're going and what they're doing, and that they're doing it safely, that they're learning along the way. Hopefully they're coming out with something, with some new knowledge, and mostly that they're having fun.
Right, because I've also been volunteered for places, and you show up, and they expected 50 people, and 100 people show up, and they don't have enough crew leaders, or they didn't cap the event out, and you're bored. And then mm-hmm. it doesn't make you feel very, as a volunteer, it does not make you feel very useful, or like the organization really cared about your time. And that's, I've found, for me as a volunteer, something that's important to me.
Absolutely. So all of the work that we do is ran by volunteers. And so we want to make sure, I mean, this is their time. This is their free time. And when you're working 5 out of 7 days a week, that free time is valuable. And we want to make sure that those people feel valued, that they feel like they're a part of something, and that actually has a cause and a purpose. And when we have people who can competently lead them, and be able to kind of move on the fly, so nothing
flexible.
Ever nothing ever turns out like you think it will, but you need to just kind of roll with it, and that's part of the crew leader training is explaining that, like, it's not always going to go the way you expect it. Be expecting it to be unexpected, and make the best of it, and make sure that people are having fun, because again, it is their time, it's their free time, and we want them to come back, and we want them to feel like they are valued.
Yeah, absolutely. So this trail school, the Crew Leader Training and Trail Sustainability Institute, together are kind of the trail school, which is a great this is a whole new world for the Northwest Trail Alliance, but also you've got some new projects you're working on to bring more trail opportunities, or that are newer, at least in the last year. June 2 Oberg, can you talk about maybe Rocky Point and what's going on there?
Yeah, so the Rocky Point area is a piece of land owned by Weyerhaeuser that's off of Highway 30. It's off of Rocky Point Road, hence the name of the trail system. We have leased 3,000 acres of
Whoa.
Land from them. We signed the lease in August and have had a number of really talented and excited folks join our fold, and they are out there. They've been out there actually building almost every Saturday in small work crews, kind of what we were talking about earlier, 6 to 10 folks just
Although,
out there.
Isn't there a bigger dig going on?
Yeah,
soon?
So there is a big dig that's coming up on March 7th, which is Saturday.
This Saturday. Just in case any of our listeners want to come out.
Yeah, and then they're also going to continue until the end of March, too. So if that ends up not being a good time, they can sign up for that at nw-trail.org. You can find all the information. It's a new location for our members to access nature on a bike. A significant amount of our membership growth is a nod to us signing this lease, and you know, the growth within our family membership too is part of this. The plans that we have are offering trails for all levels. Currently right now there's probably about 20 miles of trails.
Wow.
That are out there. Yeah.
That's a lot of trail.
Yeah,
in a short period of time.
Within the north side and the south side of the road. And then also part of our master plan is to create a family shred zone area, similar to the Family Man area up at Post Canyon. If anybody has ever been there.
So like a skills area where you can kind of do little loops and...
Yeah, it's a, you know, a recreation area where you can bring skills of all levels and enjoy nature within great sight lines and have an open space where people can just, you know, have fun on their bikes. And then also having signs, parking, kiosks, all the normal things that you would see when you're out.
And... we're running a little short on time, but it's a great opportunity. Now it's only open to members, is that correct, of the Northwest Trail Alliance?
Correct. Those are the parameters that we have to abide by based on our partnership with the landowner.
Well, and it's a super interesting partnership that I at least want to touch on before we go, in that it seems like on the East Coast this is super common that you would... Northwest Trail Alliance or someone like that would partner with a private land user because there's not as much public land out there. There are public lands here, but our public lands are, mountain bikers are being restricted to their use of those public lands. So is this private land partnership with places like Northwest, organizations like Northwest Trail Alliance, is that starting to be more common on the West Coast as well?
So private timberland owns a lot in Oregon and Washington. They're the largest land owner, so it's almost kind of a natural fit based on recreation. We're just fortunate to have land partners that value recreation and allow us into their lands to recreate. As far as continuing kind of based on the model, we have a stewardship agreement for 9,000 acres out at the coast with our subchapter, North Coast Trail Alliance, and they have a master plan to build 40 miles of trail out of Cloutchie Creek County Park. And the partner that we have there is Greenwood Resources, also known as Lewis and Clark Timberlands. We're learning a lot. It's definitely a monumental shift for our organization to become a land manager. And as far as us running around signing a bunch of other leases, we're definitely want to manage our expectations and do a really good job with what we have.
Well, you said Cloutchie Creek is 9,000?
Yeah.
And we've got 3,000. So you're up to 1,200 acres. I think that's a good, that's a good...
12,000.
Yeah. Sorry, 12,000 acres, yeah. And I think that's a pretty good start for any organization to manage. The interesting thing about the private land is they will sometimes come in and completely harvest an area that you've built in.
Yes.
Which then means you have to go in and rebuild the trail, which then leads back to Nancy Stone and the Trail Institute. And that being an essential part of the program.
Yeah, and a beautiful part of the Rocky Point property is that there's such great sight lines. If you go out there, you can see 5 mountains at any kind of peaks at any day. So it's definitely a beautiful piece of land, and I highly encourage folks to read up about it on our website, nw-trail.org, and learn more about the area.
Well, thank you to Juntu Oberg, Vice President, and Nancy Stone, Director of Education and Sustainability at the Northwest Trail Alliance, for joining us today. It was a pleasure to have you share your knowledge and expertise with our listeners. And I think you just said if our listeners want to know more, they can find out all at the NWTA.
NW-trail.org.
NW-trail.org. And we will have links to that and Friends of Gateway Green on our Facebook page if, for those of you who are interested in finding out more. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We'll have links to the Northwest Trail Alliance's and Friends of Gateway Green's websites on our Facebook page. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at thebikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by myself, April Streeter, and Alon Robb. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Ty, our web host, Chris Smith, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook or at our Twitter handle, at Bike Show, or at KBOO Bike Show, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy in Portland. Live Your Dreams Party is Wayfinding Academy's annual fundraiser. This year's theme is comfort. This event will provide a welcoming environment to kick back, relax, try something new, and learn more about the Academy's mission. Again, that's Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy, 8010 North Charleston Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.